I'm Michael Heyman, and welcome to Great British Brands and a new series of episodes that look at the secrets of some of our most iconic businesses and the art of their craft. Joining me today is James Fox of Crockett & Jones, the legendary British shoemaking brand, some five generations in the making. It boasts a who's who of fans from around the world, but perhaps none more famous than 007 himself, Daniel Craig. But unlike Bond, this is a brand that has not only shaken, but also stirred the retail world. James, welcome to Great British Brands. I have to say, it's stirred and shaken me because I'm a big fan of Crockett and Jones. So this is a real thrill to meet you. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's a great pleasure to be invited on today to take part in the podcast. It's not my first rodeo. It's not my first podcast, but I may have done one in the past. Honestly, it's a great pleasure to represent Crockett and Jones, and you know, to officiate the partnership really that we've had with the Great British Brand as a title for quite some time now.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about. I mean, you know, you've got the inside track as a family member that's seen this business change over the years. Yeah. You've got a James Bond partnership to celebrate. And of course, you know, a story of our times in terms of the intricate craft and styling that makes your shoes what they are. But let's start, you know, no time to die. Let's call it no time to spare. Because, you know, you've got this sort of the James, which is the new shoe. Tell us a little bit about what viewers of the movie are looking at when they see this incredibly well donned version of 007.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, first I'll start out by sort of congratulating Eon Productions and the Broccoli and Wilson family. Personally, I think the latest film it's been a remarkable success. It's a fantastic film. So it's a great honour to be involved in that from the perspective of a relatively small business. You know, so Crockett & Jones's reach is much, much greater than the actual size of the business. We are a relatively small shoe manufacturer in the realms of some seriously big brands, and I think we punch way above our weight, which is good to hear. But no, yeah, so the James Bond, how that came about. So I mean, it actually dates back a decade, of which I won't take you through the entire decade. We got involved with James Bond simply through Daniel Craig being a customer of Crockett & Jones. So, you know, from the way we view it, although we have recently become an official partner, so money has exchanged hands. But, you know, in the early days, you know, we very much viewed it as supporting Daniel Craig in his career and through product. And of course, we've taken the benefit of that and having such a great name wearing.
What a refreshing story, because you often sort of feel that product placement comes from,
absolutely,
you know, sort of Fifth Avenue deals. And actually, you know, just to hear that you'd got a great actor that liked great shoes, and that and you've been in most of his films, haven't you? In the Bond franchise,
we have. We've been in the last three films. So we started in Skyfall. We were also in Spectre, and we are in the latest film. But you know, to have the knowledge that we didn't place the product, we didn't beg to be involved, we didn't get the checkbook out to start with. It made it all the more important to us. But I think it also made it important to Mr. Craig on screen, and also everybody involved through Eon Productions, because they are very passionate about, you know, not making it this commercial beer moth, which, let's face it, a lot of films are these days. You know, they are very focused on, you know, supporting British and trying to get as many British made brands in that film franchise.
Well, and it's one of those truisms, which is kind of like, you know, shoes say a lot, don't they, in terms of, you know, the kind of, I guess, the sartorial flair, the look. Well, what does he like about Crockett and Jones? Has he ever said what sort of draws him to the brand?
Well, I don't personally know Mr. Craig. I don't know, the relationship is not between myself and him, but I do know that he very much likes the way our shoes fit. And actually, one of the pairs of shoes he has features in has in his personal life, actually features in No Time to Die. So we've hit for many, many years. This goes back 15 plus years. We've been making a special order because we actually discontinued the boot to Mr. Craig's dismay.
That's the sort of chukka boot, is it?
Yeah, that's right. That's the chukka boot. It's called Molten. It's a product, and it features in the latest film. We've done it in a rough out suede, which is, it's kind of a, you know, an unbeatable product in terms of, you know, wearing out and about. He's actually been buying this product as this chukka boot as a special order for many, many years. So it's quite nice actually that sort of you can really tell that he said, you know, actually, come on, I want a pair of these in the film.
So as you said, it sounds like a relaunch, not only of the franchise, but of the Beast. I mean, but
absolutely.
Of course, the shoe in this particular movie is a whole cut Oxford, a beautiful looking shoe, which you're calling the James.
I mean, that's correct.
It struck me that something like shoes is that, especially sort of men's shoes like this, is that it's all about subtle shifts and very sort of discrete changes over the course of time that gets you to something which, you know, definitely nods to its heritage. But
absolutely,
there is a very contemporary take on that shoe, isn't there? I was sort of, you know, looking at it on finally a bit of essential research where I'm just sort of like completely sort of, you know, drawn in by it. But I mean, tell us a little bit about the James as, I guess, this kind of iconic shoe for an iconic film.
Yeah, well the James is actually a celebratory product. So this particular product we launched to celebrate the official partnership between ourselves and the James Bond franchise and Eon Productions. So what we actually took, we took the very first pair of shoes that featured, that was developed for Skyfall, featured in Skyfall, and we essentially applied our every ounce of skill to that shoe. So you're looking at a hand grade version, which is our top grade level of shoemaking, of the original product that featured in James Bond. And you know, ultimately it comes down to that we were trying to create sort of the ultimate James Bond shoe. And of course, the ultimate James Bond item of clothing is the tuxedo. So essentially, if you require a shoe for, you know, wear with a tuxedo, you can't find any better, really. So it's really an upgrading of specification in every possible manner through channeled sole. Got shoulder insoles, fully leather lined with calf lining. They're fully hand polished. And then, of course, we don't really do this. It's not really our style. But of course, with James Bond, it's slightly different. With 007, the franchise were keen for us to do it. So we really went to town on things like the packaging, and we were able to.
Oh, I saw the 007 shoot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very discreet, James.
it's not really, you know, it's not terribly English in terms of what really, you said about subtle changes. It's not the most subtle product in the world. But I think something like James Bond is it's one of those very rare elements that you can celebrate.
Well, a few things I'm thinking as you're speaking. I suppose I mustn't turn this interview into being all about James Bond, but why not? But of course, over the course of the sort of James Bond movies, I mean, quite often, shoes have had a little part in the story. Rosa Klebb, one of the great villains, that had the dagger that came out of the front of her shoes. I'm sort of wondering, are we going to see in future episodes sort of Q coming in and sort of adding loads of wearable tech to your shoes?
It was a surprise to me, actually. I saw the film. I was lucky enough to go to the premiere, which I will never forget. I will always be forever thankful for that opportunity. And I actually didn't realise. Nobody told me. You know, you thought it'd get back to the family or the marketing guy, but I didn't realise that Q's actually wearing a pair of our Pembroke in tan Scotch rain in the film as well.
Well, there you go.
I can't help but think we should have put some sort of button, you know, in the heel to do something.
Absolutely. At least a Wi-Fi signal. Just as my final Bond question before moving on, but presumably these shoes went through a bit of heavy weather in terms of stunts and all the rest of it. I mean, how many pairs did he get through on set? Is that going to be a future pub quiz question on James Bond films?
I need to find out. I'm not sure how many we actually ended up supplying to No Time to Die, but I do know in previous films they've always had between 12 and 24 pairs per shoe. So it was all a little bit last minute with No Time to Die, as is always a way with family businesses. You know, it's like even James Bond doesn't make us get a wriggle on. But I think it was between 12 and 24 pairs per style. But the Molten we actually made for the film. So actually there's a Highbury, which is a 348 blasted Derby shoe that featured previously in a film. That I believe was in Spectre, I think. Whereas the Molten, actually, we developed for No Time to Die. So that is a complete new. So that the timeline for that was slightly different. So we were able to make a few more pairs for that anyway. But I'd imagine that the rate that they go through Range Rovers, I'd imagine they go through shoes as well.
Range Rovers, shoes. I mean, I can see it all. You need some good polish on those qualities.
Well, of course, Well, it's usually the first thing he lands on. So, you know, you'd expect them to take a fair beating. But just sort of finally, I did actually, this is a bit of a plug, but, you know, anyway, I'm not often shameless, but I'm going to be. I did recently read as a customer, actually, as a James Bond fan, a huge fan of Daniel Craig's and a customer. He visited a Q&A session with Daniel present. The interviewer said to Daniel, you know, if there was any prop that you could take home, what would you take home? And he sort of stared him in the eyes, said, the only prop I'm taking home is the shoes. And I thought that was rather wonderful, you know. And I think that goes to show the full circle of actually how organic our involvement is in James Bond. And with that becomes, you know, for everybody, including everyone who's making it, an immense amount of pride. Because, you know, we're not just involved with a film franchise. We're supporting a customer, which is, it makes it real for us.
Supporting a customer, and I suppose also supporting your own legend, which is you are part of the family, five-generation family business, founded in 1879. When you are, you know, at the heart of a true British classic and a proper British family business, in the sense that actually, you know, this is not a kind of 1 or 2 year old startup. This is a business that has, you know, been handed down from generation to generation. Does that bring with it different styles and responsibilities? And I suppose, what is the culture that comes with that?
Well, I mean, for a starter, I'm married in, so, you know, I'm not a Jones in any way, shape or form, but, you know, I work extremely hard for the business, for the fact that I believe, you know, I was handed the opportunity to be part of the business, and I'm grateful for that. There are different pressures in different ways of being involved in family business, especially from, you know, from the perspective of the next generation. Our fourth generation, so our current directors, you know, they worked tirelessly hard to essentially save the business from closing. So really, you can look at them as the first generation, if you like, of the family business, because they were very, very close to close Crockett & Jones in the mid-70s. When Jonathan joined the business, he made some pretty poignant decisions, which, you know, even today are still having big ramifications on the successes of Crockett & Jones. But certainly from a young person's perspective, in the early days of joining a family business, it's very frustrating because you don't join with a job title or a job role. Your job role, your mission in life is to learn every aspect of the business as best you possibly can. From my perspective, that started with, I spent a full year in the factory in the production. This is way before I even thought I may, you know, move into marketing or any type of wholesale that I do now. By doing that, by having that early freedom, you get a level of access that really no employee will really ever get within a business, because everybody normally joins a business to, you know, a function. You know, you have an efficiency, you have a cost on your head, and you have to deliver. In a family business, you do in the early days get freedom, which, you know, looking back, I'm very grateful for, because you always, so I would imagine I will never stop pulling on that level of knowledge that I gain. And, you know, when you're discussing the business, you know, like you and I now, or whether I'm speaking to my customers in Japan or Hong Kong, you know, I'm talking to them about a product that I actually know. I've had my hands on, you know, right from day one, and that is worth its weight in gold with any business, really. So I think, but the pressures moving forward from the perspective of a family business, they mount pretty quickly, you know, because you really don't stop. Holidays are not holidays anymore. And I underestimated this before I joined the family business. Holidays are not holidays, evenings are not evenings. And as much as some people in the family, they are better at switching off because it's been there all the time, I'm notoriously terrible at switching off.
Well, I suppose it's because you care, and it's I mean,
yeah, it's,
you
just
know,
passion.
Obviously, we're talking about in this series about craft, and, you know, craft. You know, when you think about craft, and you think about, you know, the great artisans over time, people that make things, is that there has to be a passion, a love. Yep. Because there is an element of artistry to it, I would imagine, in terms of just the sheer amount of workmanship and, I guess, you know, intense time that goes into creating your shoes. Because, I mean, you know, obviously the retail experience is you take them off a shelf and have a look at them, or you buy them online. But everything that goes into that is, you know, has been five generations in the making. I mean, if you were to sort of like think about some of those values, if you like, in terms of the craft of Crockett and Jones and what makes it a great British brand. What would you draw out for listeners?
Well, certainly throughout the factory, I think if you asked, you know, I may give a slightly biased opinion, but I think if you asked our staff on the factory floor who are, you know, physically making the shoes, they'll talk about the involvement of the family. They'll talk about how the passion, the drive, the intensity to move forward comes from the top of the business. You know, and you don't always get that level of buy-in from if you have too many middle management running around in business, or if you have a business that's owned by venture capitalists or run by shareholders or something, you know, all the other varieties of ways a business can be owned and run. I feel that the passion within Crockett & Jones is rife, and it's a great thing to hold on to. But you know, we put the product is the result of what we do, you know, and we're now after the redundancies of COVID. I mean, we're probably still on about 250 members of staff in the factory in Northampton. At the height of it was more like 300, you know, and each and every one of them, they'll have a key skill that they're putting into the shoes. They'll know that skill backwards. Some of the skills are more skillful than others, and they take a lot longer to learn. But the reality is, as a team, we all come together, and then, you know, one knocks onto the other, and everybody needs to be aware of everybody around them. The passion comes from the family involved and the families throughout the factory. And there, you know, there's a huge number of people in the factory who have mothers, brothers, fathers, sisters, cousins, you name it. And, you know, we sort of refer to that as factory life. But, you know, it's incredible that, you know, if one person's playing up, is you almost don't need a senior management to go down involved, because the mum comes down.
It's the collective.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh yeah, dear God, yeah. We've had so many situations where, you know, we sort of hear about something and you know, one of our supervisors happens to be there. Their you know, auntie twice removed. He's like, don't worry, I went down and felt his collar. It's like, okay, fine.
So I mean, listening to that, I mean, and I was thinking about, as you say, I mean, you know, Northampton is a close knit community, yeah. Huge shoe sort of sector there. You've also had to live and work through a pandemic, which,
yes,
presumably, when it's such a close knit group of people together, has added extra difficulty and complexity to things.
It's been amazingly stressful. From the very start of the business, there were four or five of us that stayed on pretty much for the whole period of time. But being a manufacturer, we were able to come back to work pretty quickly, actually. We came back last June. Fortunately, our factory is pretty big. So, and actually, a lot of the skill base is singular. So they sort of have their working area, and it's a good spaced out area. So as long as people were sensible, we put one-way systems in around the factory, multiple staircases. It worked relatively well, actually. And you know, we really have to pay thanks to our staff for that, because everybody, 99% of the staff in the factory took it very, very seriously. And it enabled us to stay up and running and, you know, to really the success of the business throughout the pandemic. Because, you know, like every other business, we have lost a huge amount of money. But, you know, this comes back to being a family-run business. You know, we don't overinvest. We're not driven by greed. We're not driven by, you know, huge dividend payments, or, you know, we don't have to. I mean, obviously we need to make a profit, but we're not driven by decisions that are run by money and purely money. You know, we want to be in business in 100 years time. So we're a relatively conservative business. So we had good cash reserves before the pandemic started, because, you know, we don't know when we want to invest in our own retail stores. We don't want to have to go to the bank to borrow money. So actually, you know, having that conservative mentality really helped us.
And I suppose you can see that in terms of, I suppose, the broader position of the business in terms of its attitude to things in the future. But I suppose the thing I was thinking about is that a lot of people have lived and worked through this experience, and they'll often conclude that something's changed. You know, that actually the sense of a, you know, band of brother and sisters working together better or worse, or, you know, it's interesting is that it's not a uniform answer, but there is some sense that COVID changes things in the way that businesses look and see the future because of what they've lived through. And I was just wondering, does a family business like Crockett and Jones you know, enter this next chapter slightly differently? Or actually, is it the fact that there are five generations to bring perspective to this that allows you to sort of, you know, plow on with that in mind?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was talking to my brother-in-law about this. It's, you know, we're all of the same agreement, really. It's, we are quite thankful that this pandemic hit when our fourth generation, so his father and his uncle, were still in the head of the business, because there's absolutely, you know, they pulled on all of their experience when sort of navigating their way through the last 18 months. So, you know, there's no doubt about it, having the two directors really at the peak of their experience at the top of the business very much helped us tread water, but ultimately thrive. You know, and we're doing very well at the moment, which is great. It's picking up, business is picking up very quickly.
I was going to ask so are we returning to more formal wear in that respect? Well, or are you changing accordingly?
Absolutely. You were asking about change, which I think is a very interesting point, because some people are sort of, you know, their change would be if they're working in an office, you know, they're split. They may not see colleagues for long periods of time between week to week. And, you know, that may have a social impact on them. It may have a positive impact on them because they spend more time with their children. From our perspective, I think a lot of our staff have been very, you know, very happy to be able to sort of come to work and socialize. And of course, when you're actually, you know, using a skill, it's a bit like riding a bike to a certain extent, but actually that skill needs to be in practice all the time to make sure that you can uphold that skill level. So, you know, we're happy that we've been able to stay up and running in some way or another, but the change actually comes from, you know, something that we were already seeing before the pandemic. You know, the reality is, you know, if you look back at our product collections, well, funny enough, I was doing this yesterday for someone who was asking when we produced our first loafer. But actually, if you look back in the products that we had in our early catalogues, it was just Oxford, you know, calf, maybe the odd suede Oxford, if you're lucky, but that was really pushing the boat out. But actually, over the last decade, you know, we have been seeing a steady movement away from leather sole, for example. Certainly in some markets love a leather sole, some markets don't. But we're probably down to 50% of production before the pandemic of leather to rubber.
That's right, because everybody wants the Goodyear sole to sort of like see through the bad weather. But the other thing I was thinking about, by the way, is that, you know, lockdown. I mean, my faithful friend through lockdown had been a pair of Crockett and Jones velvet skull and crossbones slippers, which have been, you know, I've got to say, a very comfortable friend.
Yeah.
And I suppose, you know, you've got to change, because change is everywhere. And it's not just in terms of what we're wearing and styles. Mm. But I mean, there are now big issues at play here, of which, you know, sustainability, environment, the expectations of consumers that they're going to buy their products from people that are respectful to the planet. I mean, does that play out now in terms of the expectations on your business and the relationships with consumers?
Well, I think it was always there. There's nothing drastically new or you know, unexpected that hasn't happened. I think what COVID's done, or the pandemic has done, I think really it's just sped up what was already happening in fashion around the world. You know, seasonality they were already discussing about seasonality going out of the window. Big companies were changing to quarterly seasons. And, you know, from our perspective, actually, I reminded my managing director, my father-in-law, a few weeks ago that in 2019, our biggest selling style was in fact a loafer for the first time in the company's history. Prior to that, it had always been a business Oxford, a black calf Oxford, you know, right up until 2019. So, but now, you know, you say your faithful is a velvet slipper. I've lived in unlined suede loafers. And, you know, I don't walk around my house, because these days in houses, everybody has tiled floors. So, you know, there's not too many people that have carpet throughout their entire house.
But what I'm thinking is that, you know, when you look at trends like slow fashion and things that are happening, which are about, you know, I suppose the conclusion of them is that possibly buy better quality, but buy less of it. You say definitely. So my question was going to be, how does that play to a brand like Crockett and Jones, where I suppose, you know, some of your customers will have been wearing that, you know, your shoes for a very long time. But you also need to sell presumably quite a lot to keep the engine running.
Yeah, we do. You know, we definitely need to sell a lot to keep the engine running. You know, we are a manufacturer. We're not just, you know, dialing up an order process to a factory in Italy or Indonesia or Brazil or wherever. But I think there's two elements elements to sustainability. And I think it's something actually that Crockett and Jones is, I know these buzzwords come around in the fashion world, they latch onto them and they go viral. But actually Crockett and Jones has been enforcing sustainability onto its customers for since day one, simply through the fact that, we make a product that lasts. The product represents great value, but the product actually does what it says on the tin, which is sadly kind of rare these days. It's a product that is sustainable through various means. It's sustainable through the materials that we're using. It's sustainable through its repairability. But even if you're not the kind of end consumer who is going to send his shoes back to use our repair service, it's still a very well made product. So as long as you've got a few pairs in rotation, you let them dry, through wears, it's absolutely fine. And I think the other element to sustainability, which you've sort of touched on a little bit already, which I think the fashion world really needs to sit up and understand, and the only way they're going to understand this is if they allow their designers to look more at heritage businesses like Crockett & Jones. We may be small, but we're mighty because we know our industry incredibly well. And that's the fact that I cannot tell you how important this is to sustainability. We make products because customers want to buy them, or we make products that customers want to buy. We always, without fail, when we're producing new collections for wholesale and retail, we always ask ourselves the questions, would we wear it? If the answer is no, it gets nowhere near the collection. If the answer is yes, well, it's more likely the 100 to 300 other blokes fancy putting these whatever loafers on. So it's so important in sustainability.
No, I know. Well, and I'm just sort of thinking as you're talking, is that there's so many routes to go down on this in terms of actually where the market goes. But I'm also conscious that I'm running out of time with you. And I just wanted to sort of like get a last thought from you about how the world of digital has impacted a traditional brand. Because, it always struck me that you were sort of resolutely obstinate at one stage in the sense that, you didn't sell online. And I mean, obviously, you've come to the party now. And I always felt, well, that kind of reinforces why you go where you go. I remember I always love you've got a small store on Burlington Arcade, as you'll know, and you've got a manager in there. I don't know if he's still there, but I mean, he's the ultimate relationship seller. It got me thinking, how do you take that personality, that style, that heritage, and take it into the ultimate sort of 21st century medium?
Yeah, I mean, it's so absolutely, you're correct. We were late to the party with, you're alluding to e-commerce sales or an online sales channel, which, was it the right or was it the wrong decision to wait that long? But, you can argue either way, but it's certainly been fun and games navigating our way through sort of blending the old with the new. But it's something I think we've done relatively successful. Essentially, we're pitching our e-commerce to our customers in, through service level. So, really, we ultimately want our customers to go into our stores. We want them to buy their very first pair of shoes always from a Crockett & Jones retail store or stockist. If for some reason they then cannot get the style that they want, or it's out of stock, or they are supporting one of our wholesale customers around the world and then they want to try some of our London MTOs, they're available to buy online. The key really to Crockett & Jones' success online, and we have been really successful in the first 6 months, is that if you are a size 8 in 3, 4, 8 last, we don't just have the one shoe on that last. You can buy a mini collection to that last, to your size, and then with that last, so we know that the 3, 4, 1 last is a very similar fitting to the 3, 4, 8. So we can advise, and I think that's the key to it, is that we have an extensive collection of customers around the world, really through all walks of life, from senior directors to company owners, celebrities to just average guys like me. And it's I feel like that bringing our product range in its entirety to those customers around the world, it enables them to buy more efficiently, but hopefully is repeat purchasing in terms of knowing their fitting.
And I think not only that, buying the dream as well. And I think, thanks for sharing it, James, with us on this this edition of Great British Brands. And I'm thinking I'm gonna go and don my velvet slippers and release my inner Daniel Craig in sort of celebration of the great Crockett and Jones.
Yeah, you do that. Yeah, thank you very much, Mike. It's been a pleasure. Hopefully we touched on some interesting topics for your readers as well.
We certainly did.